The world is still reeling from an Israeli attack on Rafah.
Hours after an Israeli airstrike triggered a massive blaze in a tent camp where displaced people were taking shelter. Dozens were killed, according to Palestinian officials in Hamas-run Gaza.
Plus, the Georgian parliament overrides the president's veto on the foreign agents bill.
Most of the protesters are hoping that this anger, frustration, and disappointment will translate into political action.
And later, an update from Kyiv, a look at some deadly weather, and the latest from Papua New Guinea. Today is Tuesday, May 28th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A developing story off the top here today. Gaza's Civil Defense Agency said an Israeli strike has killed at least 21 people at a displacement camp west of the southern city of Rafah on Tuesday. This just days after a similar strike that sparked global outrage. There's been no word yet from the Israelis. For the latest, visit voanews.com. And as we reported on Monday's show, an Israeli airstrike in Rafah on Sunday killed dozens of civilians, along with two Hamas leaders who were the targets of the attack. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the incident will be investigated. For more, we turn to Angela Johnston of Reuters.
Palestinians sifted through smoking wreckage in Rafah on Monday as others mourned the dead. Hours after an Israeli airstrike triggered a massive blaze in a tent camp where displaced people were taking shelter. Dozens were killed, according to Palestinian officials in Hamas-run Gaza, who said the toll was likely to rise. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Parliament the strike was not intended to kill civilians.
In Rafah, we already evacuated about 1 million non-combatant residents. And despite our utmost effort not to harm non-combatants, something unfortunately went tragically wrong. We are investigating the incident and will reach conclusions because this is our policy.
The attack has prompted an outcry from global leaders who are now calling for implementation of a Friday ruling from the UN's top court, ordering Israel to stop its assault on Rafah. Israel had kept up its offensive, saying the court ruling grants it some scope for military action there.
I saw images. They are deeply disturbing and horrifying.
The head of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, or UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, said he was waiting to hear more about casualties from his team.
There is no safe space in Gaza.
The U.S. called images following the strike devastating and urged Israel to take every precaution to protect civilians. On social media, French President Emmanuel Macron said he was outraged. The German foreign minister and EU foreign policy chief called for the court's ruling to be respected.
I condemn this in the stronger terms.
More than 36,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's offensive, Gaza's health ministry says. Israel launched the operation after Hamas-led militants attacked southern Israeli communities on October 7th, killing around 1,200 people and seizing more than 250 hostages, according to Israeli tallies. Israel says it wants to root out Hamas fighters holed up in Rafah and rescue hostages it says are being held in the area. Israel's military said Sunday's strike, based on, quote, precise intelligence, had eliminated Hamas's chief of staff for the West Bank, plus another official behind deadly attacks on Israelis.
Angela Johnston of Reuters reporting for us, and the United Nations Security Council is expected to discuss the strike later Tuesday afternoon. Check our website for latest info. A spokesperson for the Israeli military said on Tuesday, the army has launched an investigation into the strike that sparked that deadly fire at the tent camp.
The strike was conducted using two munitions with small warheads suited for this targeted strike. We're talking about munition with 17 kilos of explosive material. This is the smallest munition that our jets can use. Following this strike, a large fire ignited for reasons that are still being investigated. Our munition alone could not have ignited a fire of this size. I want to repeat it. Our munition alone could not have ignited a fire of this size.
Israeli military spokesperson Daniel Hagari said the military fired two 17-kilogram munitions that targeted two senior Hamas militants. The fire could have been ignited by fuel, cooking gas canisters, stockpiles of weapons, or other materials. Meanwhile, thousands of residents in Papua New Guinea were ordered by the government on Tuesday to evacuate from the path of a still-active landslide that buried alive an estimated 2,000 people last week. Sahir Jasny reports.
The government of Papua New Guinea ordered thousands of residents to evacuate on Tuesday over fears of further landslides. Officials say the situation remains unstable following Friday's disaster, with rocks and debris still tumbling down the mountain. They have informed the UN that the landslide in a remote village buried over 2,000 people. Relief teams have been slowly reaching the remote northern Anger region since Friday, but finding more survivors looks increasingly unlikely. Heavy equipment and aid have been delayed due to the remote location, difficult terrain, and tribal unrest, which has forced the military to escort relief convoys. The Anger Province Disaster Committee says a state of emergency has been declared in the area, affecting thousands. Military personnel are manning checkpoints and assisting in relocating residents to evacuation centers. Former local government head Jiman Yandam vowed to keep looking for the missing.
Tomorrow morning and every day we will get strength from the food we're given and we will continue to dig. We don't know where the bodies are buried, but we will not give up. We will keep going. The large volume of soil and boulders are making it too difficult for us, so we are using manual labor with spades and iron rods to dig. If we are lucky, we will find the bodies. Otherwise, they are buried forever.
The UN has put the possible death toll at 670, far lower than local estimates. But the varying figures stems from challenges in accurately assessing the population. The last reliable census was in 2000, and the 2022 voter roll doesn't include those under 18.
That's Reuters' Sahir Jasny reporting for us today. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The world has seen some deadly weather recently. We'll take a look in a moment. First, though, off to Kyiv and news of President Volodymyr Zelensky's European travels and new bilateral agreements and the Ukrainian efforts to end the restrictions on where they can use American-made weapons. VOA's Anna Chernikova has the details.
On Monday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Spain to sign a long-term security agreement. The document provides 1 billion euros in military aid from Spain to Ukraine for 2024 and 5 billion euros for the period until 2027 through the European Peace Fund. Following that, on Tuesday, Zelensky arrived in Belgium, where he met with Prime Minister Alexander De Croo. The two countries signed a bilateral long-term security cooperation agreement. According to Zelensky, the document provides for at least 977 million euros in military aid to Ukraine from Belgium in 2024, as well as Brussels' commitment to support Kyiv during the 10-year term of the agreement. The president of Ukraine also said that for the first time such an agreement specifies the exact number of 30 F-16 fighter jets that will be delivered to Ukraine by 2028. The first aircraft should arrive in Ukraine by the end of 2024. During a press conference in Brussels, Zelensky talked about the peace summit in Switzerland, which will be held in June.
Я би дуже хотів, щоб особисто був присутній президент Байден.
He mentioned that he would very much like President Biden to personally attend the summit. Zelensky noted that America supports the summit, but there is still no understanding of at what level. He said he believes that other leaders are looking at the actions of the United States. Zelensky believes that Vladimir Putin will be comforted if U.S. President Joe Biden ignores the peace summit in Switzerland. Earlier, the USA announced that their country will be represented at the peace summit, but it is currently unknown who will attend. It is also expected that the President of Ukraine will visit Portugal on Tuesday. This was reported by the press service of the President of Portugal. The purpose of the visit is to strengthen cooperation in the field of security and defense, as well as political, military, financial, and humanitarian support for Kyiv. The President of Ukraine's visits were previously planned for mid-May. However, due to the situation at the front line, Volodymyr Zelensky postponed all international business trips. Meanwhile, the situation at the Russia-Ukraine front line remains tough. Ukrainian authorities expect a new wave of Russian attacks on Kharkiv and the Kharkiv region, as Russian forces have not yet been able to create a buffer zone along the entire line of the Ukraine-Russia border in the Kharkiv region. Russian forces did have partial success, though the Ukrainian military managed to stabilize the situation in certain areas. The city of Kharkiv remains under constant Russian shelling, with more than 20 people killed and over 60 injured over the weekend alone. There is also an increased danger for the Sumy region, as Russian forces intensify the shelling of that area and might try to create a buffer zone there too, connected to the one in the Kharkiv region. Amid the recent deathly shelling of the city of Kharkiv, Ukraine intensified the negotiations with the allies, asking to allow Ukraine to use Western weapons to hit the targets on the territory of Russia. Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, insists that the allies need to review the restrictions on Ukraine's ban on striking the Russian Federation with Western weapons, particularly amid the border fighting in the Kharkiv region. The NATO Parliamentary Assembly also called on the governments of the alliance countries to allow Ukraine to strike targets on the territory of the Russian Federation with Western weapons. A number of countries, including Poland and Lithuania, have also called to leave these restrictions. This is a developing story. We will provide updates in the following programs. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And in another former Soviet republic, Georgia's parliament voted on Tuesday to override a presidential veto of the Foreign Agents Bill that has plunged the South Caucasus country into crisis, ignoring criticism from the West, which says the legislation is authoritarian and Russian-inspired. The vote is so heated that a Georgian opposition member of parliament was splashed with water during a parliamentary debate. He was delivering a speech against the bill when a pro-government MP splashed him with water. Tuesday's vote to ignore the objections of President Salome Zurabishvili sets the stage for the Speaker of Parliament to sign the bill into law in the coming days. For more, I'm joined by VOA's Anna Chikvadze in Tbilisi. Ani, we know that Parliament has overridden the veto of the president on the so-called Foreign Agents Bill. What's the situation there now?
You can hear it in the background, the voice of the Georgian protesters, those who gathered around the Georgian Parliament today. They have been protesting for over a month now, the so-called Russian law, as many see it here at the demonstration. However, the Georgian Parliament did not listen to those taking the streets, and they did not also listen to the Western partners who have warned them against passing this law. People are angry here on the streets and disappointed by the recent actions. You hear chants such as, Russians, Russians, towards the parliamentarians, 84 of them who voted in favor of this legislation. And those standing here are vowed to continue the protest until the upcoming general elections in the country that will determine if the ruling Georgian Dream Party will stay in power or not. The Western partners have also expressed concerns around this law concerning the NGOs and non-governmental organizations that are monitoring the elections, and about the climate that the passage of this legislation creates in the country ahead of critical elections. And we will see what will be the next steps of the United States and European Union, those who have warned the Georgian counterparts against taking these measures and against passing this law. And the U.S. Government has come out and stated that the State Department is working on a policy that would include visa restrictions against those who participated in the passage of this law in the Georgian government as well as in the Georgian parliament.
And we know that the protests have been going on for a long time. We know that the people who are protesting are certainly adamantly against this bill. But is that a majority of Georgian citizens?
Georgia has not seen this large protest since it gained independence in 1991. As you know, this law was reintroduced by the Georgian ruling party after last year's widespread protest. Back then, they withdrew the legislation. However, a year later, they pushed it through the parliament. Nevertheless, you know, there are tens of thousands of people taking the streets. These are the largest protests the country has seen since 1991, when it gained independence from the Soviet Union. So whether that reflects the majority of the country, it's unclear. However, around 80% of Georgians support Georgia's declared European path, as well as 73% support Georgia's aspirations towards the NATO. And since this law is seen by those taking the street as a hindrance in that process, one could argue that majority of Georgians do share this concern and do feel not listened to by their own government.
Now, Annie, we know that the veto was overridden today. It has not yet officially become law. When do we expect this to happen?
Well, after the prime minister signs the legislation, we will see the law go into effect. It takes start in August, and from August on, those receiving 20% of their funding from foreign sources, and largely this is seen to be directed at the U.S. and the EU democratic assistance towards the civil society and media, will be required to register in the registry of those who carry out foreign interests.
Now, Annie, we can hear the protests going on behind you. You've told us that they're large. Are they safe? Is there violence? Is there much of a police presence?
There is a police presence here. However, compared to previous days, I would say the police, there is not that many police officers here. They allowed the members of the parliament to leave the area, and they had a corridor for that. But right now, the protests are largely peaceful. And considering that Georgia has the upcoming elections in October, most of the protesters are hoping that this anger, frustration, and disappointment will translate into political action at the polling stations in the at the next elections in October.
Ani Chikagvadze in Tbilisi. Ani, thanks so much for your reporting. Stay safe out there for us.
Thank you very much, Steve.
On Monday, severe storms brought heavy rain to parts of the eastern United States, and central states cleaned up the debris after the same storm system killed at least 22 people and injured hundreds more. The storms destroyed homes in Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. Tens of thousands of residents lost power through the weekend. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders declared a state of emergency after severe storms demolished areas in the northwest part of the state, leaving at least 8 people there dead.
We are in still an assessment phase. We're going to have to continue to focus in the immediate on the rescue side as we move into the recovery. The rebuilding efforts will come. This is not going to be a short process.
5 people died in Kentucky and 2 in Oklahoma, according to authorities. 7 people, including 2 children, died in Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott said about 100 people were injured and more than 200 homes and buildings were destroyed. In other climate news, temperatures soared above 50 degrees Celsius in parts of Pakistan on Monday as an ongoing heat wave gripped more areas, including the southern district of Sikkur. The heat wave is forecast to continue for at least a few more days as doctors are treating victims of heat stroke at hospitals across the country. Heat stroke relief camps manned by volunteers have been set up to provide ice water for people in Sikkur, with residents saying the government has done nothing to help them. That's Salim Abbas. He says he drinks cold water and sugarcane juice when he must be outside for work, adding that he has no choice. Pakistan's meteorological department says the country could experience more episodes of extremely high temperatures ahead of the pre-monsoon rains. Officials say the current heat wave is being experienced due to climate change and is the latest climate-related disaster to hit the country in recent years. Meanwhile, authorities in the neighboring Indian state of Rajasthan blame the heat for 6 deaths there. Life expectancy in Europe has returned to the level it reached before the 2020 coronavirus pandemic, while the U.S. is still trying to regain lost ground. Overall, new numbers show life expectancy has increased in most parts of the world, with Eastern Sub-Saharan Africa showing the biggest gains over the past 3 decades. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports.
Latest European Union figures released this month show the average life expectancy across the bloc in 2023 was 81.5 years, almost a year's gain over 2022 as the coronavirus pandemic was coming to an end. Jennifer Beam-Dowd is a professor of demography and population health at the University of Oxford.
Within Europe, we're seeing really high life expectancy in countries like Spain and Italy, Sweden, Norway. But some countries are falling behind their peers, and that includes the UK. And then Eastern Europe has made a lot of progress since the post-Soviet mortality crisis of the 90s, but they're still lagging behind a bit.
A recent study in the Lancet journal showed that globally, life expectancy increased by 6.2 years between 1990 and 2021, with Eastern Sub-Saharan Africa experiencing the largest increase of some 10.7 years. Again, Jennifer Beam-Dowd.
I think that's really good news and reflects a lot of continued progress all over the world in falls in infectious disease and infant and child mortality, which makes a big difference to life expectancy because you're saving a lot of years of life if you save lives at young ages.
Figures released in March showed average life expectancy in the United States in 2022, the most recent data available, was 77.5 years, still more than a year lower than the life expectancy before the pandemic. Figures for 2023 have not yet been released. Again, Jennifer Beam-Dowd.
A lot of countries have bounced back close to pre-pandemic life expectancy. But some countries, such as the U.S., have not returned yet to the levels they were at in 2019. But another thing that's having a big impact, we think, right now is the obesity epidemic, which started taking off, especially in the U.S. in the early 1980s. And in fact, we are seeing major slowdowns and improvements from cardiovascular disease that are driving a lot of the stalling life expectancy in high-income countries.
The European Principality of Monaco, a favorite home for the super rich, had the world's highest life expectancy in 2023 at almost 90 years, according to U.S. figures. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.